Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to the September 2016 edition of First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System, where we go over recent developments in the last month that are of interest to those who are involved in the public safety, workplace, and labor relations issues. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so. As we go over some, this time, at least a couple of very significant cases that have been decided in the last month. Hopefully I'll get beyond those two cases. One's a pension case, one's a donning and doffing case. Hopefully I get beyond that to some of the other cases that aren't going to quite have the national significance, but we'll see. First of all, if you have a question about a workplace issue that you'd like us to weigh in on, give us a call at 503-836-5255 and leave us a voicemail. Indicate in your voicemail not only what your question is, but also what state you're from so that we know whether or not you've got collective bargaining, and let us know whether or not we can use your question for our monthly podcast. We'd love to be able to play a couple of those. Okay, now let's get into the recent developments, and in particular, let's start with a donning and doffing case. Boy, do I have to set a little bit of background on this and do a little bit of personal disclosure. Donning and doffing, the notion that under the Fair Labor Standards Act, there can be compensation for putting on and taking off a uniform and equipment pre and post shift. Donning and doffing is not a new FLSA notion. There are cases from the U.S. Supreme Court going back more than 50 years holding that donning and doffing can, under some circumstances, be considered as compensable work under the FLSA. Probably the most important of those Supreme Court cases is one of those oldies but goodies. It is a case that involved workers in a battery acid plant, where what they donned and doffed were not only old clothes, that's the way the Supreme Court describes them, but also some equipment that they used to shield themselves from the acid that was present in the battery factory. And the court found that that was work, that that was an integral and indispensable part of their daily activities, the donning and doffing. Well, donning and doffing, at least as a legal theory, lay dormant for a number of years, and then it started getting picked up in, of all places, poultry and other forms of meat processing plants. And in these sorts of work environments, you had employees who were not only putting on and taking off clothing, gowns and gloves and things like that, but they also had knives they had to sharpen and various other pre- and post-shift activities related to both equipment and clothing. And courts routinely, up to and including the U.S. Supreme Court, found those activities to be compensable. Then, in the first part of the 2000s, law enforcement officers discovered donning and doffing. And in a lot of cases, around the West Coast, but centered in California, in a lot of cases, police officers took a look at these other donning and doffing cases and said, hey, we're putting on uniforms, we're putting on protective gear, why isn't donning and doffing compensable for us? And there were a number of lawsuits that were filed around 2004, 2005, 2006, seeking compensation for donning and doffing on the part of police officers. A lot of those cases were settled on the basis of officers getting that compensation, and often with shifts being adjusted so that the donning and doffing time would occur as part of the normal work shift. Then, finally, one of the cases made it up to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. This is the Federal Court of Appeals that's in the western part of the United States. And a three-judge panel for the Ninth Circuit, by a 2-to-1 vote, found that if the employer allows employees, officers, to don and doff at home, then the whole activity of donning and doffing is not compensable work, no matter whether it's performed at home or at work. And the court's rationale was that if you let somebody do it at home, well, it's not really that big of an imposition on their time, and it's not really like work. And that stopped, at least for courts in the Ninth Circuit, that stopped all litigation over donning and doffing in its tracks in these a bunch of California cases that were pending, some Arizona cases, and the like. But it didn't stop all donning and doffing litigation for police officers in its tracks. Within a month and a half of the Ninth Circuit's decision in that case, which involved the city of Mesa, within a month and a half, you had another federal court, this one in Colorado, not in the Ninth Circuit, that's in the Tenth Circuit, where Denver police officers were bringing a donning and doffing claim. And a federal court judge there looked at the Ninth Circuit's decision in the Mesa case and said, that's interesting, but I'm not in the Ninth Circuit, and that decision doesn't make any sense to me. And it doesn't make any sense because if donning and doffing is work, and we know from all these Supreme Court cases that donning and doffing is work, how can it make sense to say that if the employer lets the employees do the work at home, that's not a compensable activity anymore under the FLSA? What about, and this is an example the judge used, what about if a police department said to detectives, look, from now on, you can make all your phone calls at home? Does that transform the activity of making phone calls related to the job into a non-compensable one under the FLSA? It can't, says the judge. And his decision there led to a multi-million dollar settlement on behalf of Denver police officers. So that's the history. Now for the disclosure. I'm the lawyer who lost the City of Mesa case before the Ninth Circuit, and I'm the lawyer who won the Denver case. So I have personal involvement and obviously a personal point of view about all of this, these cases and that issue. By the way, if you ever want to see a very good example of a lawyer getting humiliated in oral argument before a court, my oral argument before the Ninth Circuit in that City of Mesa case, somebody video recorded that and put it on YouTube. I simply do not have the gumption to go watch that. I'm afraid that would be way too painful. So, what's going on now? What's going on now is another federal court of appeals has weighed in on the issue of donning and doffing for somebody kind of like a police officer. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. And has a new approach to the issue. It's not a City of Mesa approach. It's not a City of Denver approach. It's something kind of in the middle. And I think this has the potential to revive donning and doffing cases all around the country for law enforcement officers. So what's the case? The case involves employees who are classified as urban park rangers who work for the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation. What do park rangers do? They give directions to people who want to use parks and pools. They provide assistance to people who are involved in accidents and have safety problems. They implement crowd control procedures. They provide safety and education information to the public. And they issue summons and occasionally will make arrests of persons who are suspected of unlawful conduct in the parks or the pools of New York City. Can't believe that ever happens, but apparently it does. What do they wear? Well, they wear olive drab pants and a jacket. They wear what the court refers to as Smokey the Bear-style hats with various Parks Department insignias, and they carry equipment and wear equipment. What do they wear? Bulletproof vest and a utility belt holding handcuffs, gloves, radio, flashlight, baton, a can of mace, summons book, and a tape recorder. Does that sound like familiar equipment to anybody listening to this podcast? It's police equipment, right? Minus a few things like the firearm, but it's police equipment. The Rangers estimated that the time they needed to don and doff the uniforms and equipment each day ranged from 5 to 30 minutes in length. The city wasn't compensating them, so they sued. Went to a federal court judge in the Southern District of New York, a trial court judge, one of the most cantankerous trial court judges I've ever had the pleasure or lack of pleasure of appearing in front of, and she threw the case out. This wasn't my case, by the way. I appeared in front of her in another case. She threw the case out. And why'd she throw the case out? She said, I'm basically buying into that City of Mesa theory. And also, I think these things that these Rangers are donning and doffing, I think those are analogous to normal clothing. They're not specialized enough work gear to really warrant any compensation for donning and doffing. And the park rangers then appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeal. Second Circuit, by the way, one of forever, one of the most respected of the I think we have 13 separate courts of appeals, federal courts of appeals in the country, 11 of which are kind of geographically oriented. The Second Circuit long thought that there's a lot of brain power up in the Second Circuit. And I'd say from, you know, reading these cases from around the country, that with the Seventh Circuit, which is in Illinois, that area, the Second Circuit, those two courts are probably the best federal courts in the country right now in terms of getting opinions out of them where you can understand them and they make sense, they hang together, and they're useful in guiding both sides in their future conduct with respect to whatever issue it might be. So what does the Second Circuit say about this donning and doffing case? The court says, lower court, you threw the case out too early. We think that a reasonable fact finder could find that the donning and doffing of uniforms are integral and indispensable, that's an FLSA buzz phrase, to their principal activities as rangers. Why? Because these are activities undertaken for the employer's benefit. The employee doesn't have a choice. The Parks Department prescribes the components of the uniform in painstaking detail, and rangers can be disciplined for noncompliance with putting on the right uniform items. Does that sound familiar at all to anybody listening to this podcast? More fundamentally, the court says, the uniforms appear to be vital to the primary goal of the work performed during the shift. The utility belt holds items that are used to perform law enforcement duties. A summons book, says the court, is necessary for the issuance of summonses. Baton, mace, handcuffs may be used in effecting an arrest. Radio and flashlight can prove crucial in tracking suspects. We think that these are analogous to a butcher's knife in these various meatpacking plant donning and doffing case. And this is even analogous to a canine officer's dog. And we've held that feeding the dog off duty and training the dog and grooming the dog off duty is compensable. So we think a reasonable fact finder, i.e. a jury, could determine the donning and doffing of the ranger's utility belt and uniform are integral and indispensable tasks. What about the City of Mesa notion? That if the employer gives the employees the option and ability to don and doff at home, that makes the whole work non-compensable. The court says, we think that giving somebody the ability to don and doff at home is one factor to be considered in the compensability of the activity. We don't think it's the only factor. The case doesn't end there, because we think, in addition to where you can don and doff, we think factors like the nature of the equipment and the uniform, the purpose to which it is put during the employee shift, all of those things are factors that have to be taken into account by the fact finder in deciding whether donning and doffing is a compensable activity. In other words, the door is now back open to donning and doffing litigation in this country. It'll be interesting to see how many law enforcement officers step through that door. By the way, when we had these donning and doffing cases before, you really only saw them filed by police officers, not by corrections officers and not by firefighters. And I think the reason is that generally speaking, corrections officers and firefighters don't carry the gear that police officers do. They're just donning and doffing the uniform, and courts tend to think that if it's just a uniform, even if it's a specialized uniform like a police officer's uniform, if it's just the uniform and not the gear, then you're not going to get compensation for it. So I wouldn't anticipate we'd see a bunch of corrections or firefighter suits here, but I'd be really surprised if we didn't see a bunch of police suits come back with us, or police lawsuits, that is, come back with us. Now let's turn to the other really big case that was decided in the last month, actually just a couple of days ago. It's as of the time I'm recording this podcast. This one comes from California. It's a pension case. And if this case stands, it has the potential to fundamentally change the law in California with respect to the reduction of pension benefits for active employees. Now, no one questions whether or not you can have a two-tiered pension system where new employees don't get the benefits that existing employees get. But for the longest time, it has been thought by courts all over the country that if employees, active employees, are vested in their pension system, that is, if they put in the minimum number of years of work in order to be entitled to pension benefits, if they're vested, that the employer can't diminish those pension benefits without some sort of offsetting enhancement to the pension. So you treat existing employees differently than you treat new employees. Why? Because the pension arrangement is thought to be a contract where on one side of the equation, employees give their service to the employer over time, forego other employment opportunities, and on the other side of the equation, they earn a pension. And the idea is that if you take away one half of that equation, you reduce the pension, that is an impairment of contract that violates the Constitution. What part of the Constitution? Well, federal Constitution has a clause that prohibits governmental bodies from impairing what's known as the obligation of contract. It's called the Contracts Clause to the U.S. Constitution. It's not used all that often, but it does come up from time to time, particularly in a lot of pension cases. Most state constitutions, including California's, have their own version of a contracts clause. In some cases, the contracts clauses specifically reference pensions. In Alaska, for example, the Alaska Constitution has a contracts clause that articulates that pension benefits can't be reduced. But most places, it's just a general contracts a clause that prohibits a governmental body from interfering with an existing contract. All right, so that's our background. What's going on in this California case? Well, it involves a group of local governmental employers in Marin County, outside of the Bay Area. These governmental employers all work together in the same pension system. It's kind of a consolidated pension system. And for years, the county's pension board has included a variety of pay supplements. I'm going to refer to them as pay supplements in this discussion. A variety of pay supplements in the retirement calculation. Those pay supplements have included standby pay, something called administrative response pay, callback pay, cash payment for waiving health insurance, and other sort of minor pay items. It's included in the calculation of the retirement benefits for employees. And it's included in two ways. First of all, when the employer makes payments to employees for any of these pay supplements, there are retirement contributions that are taken out for both the employer and the employee. Secondly, when pensions are eventually calculated, those payments, if they fall within the employee's final average salary period upon which pensions are calculated, those payments are taken into consideration. So that's gone on forever and ever, long time in Marin County. In 2013, enter the California legislature. And the California legislature passes something that is known in California as PEPRA. And PEPRA, it's an acronym for the Public Employee Pension Reform Act. What it is a cutback of pension benefits that is mandated at the state level. California has a lot of underfunded pension programs, including the state PERS, not the worst in the country. Illinois, I think, still has that distinction, but California does have a number of underfunded pension systems, and the state legislature basically said, enough is enough. And what the legislature did was to cap pension systems for new hires. You couldn't have a 3% at 50 benefit, which was very common for California police and fire. Couldn't have that anymore. The benefit was capped. It forced employees to pay higher pension contributions, up to 12%, and in some cases perhaps even more. And Pepper also said, we're going to try to take a shot at pension spiking. What's pension spiking? That's where employees get some sort of benefit in their final average salary period just before they retire that spikes their pensions. It might be in the form of a cash payout for accrued but unused vacation time or sick leave. There's other forms of pension spiking that exist. And what the legislature does is to basically say to local retirement boards like that one in Marin County, hey, if you're able to determine that certain benefits are there for the purposes of pension spiking, you can stop including them in the pension contributions, and you can stop including them in the pension benefits. And here's the key. When Marin County very quickly adopts a policy, or the pension system adopts policy in Marin County, with respect to the supplemental pay, it decides to not include the supplemental pay in the pension calculations, not just for new hires, but also for existing employees. And of course, the employees representing the unions file a lawsuit, and they are citing a 33-year-old California Supreme Court case that pretty clearly says that if you're going to cut back pension benefits for existing employees, you got to increase benefits somewhere else in the pension system so that you have some sort of offset. Well, the lawsuit filed by the unions goes through a trial court and then up to the California Court of Appeals. Now, I'm sure all of you know this, but just in case, the way courts have a hierarchy. The highest state court in a state is usually called a Supreme Court. Some places, like New York, it's called something else, but most states, it's called a Supreme Court. Underneath the Supreme Court is a Court of Appeals. Decisions from a Court of Appeals can be appealed to a Supreme Court, which has discretion as to whether or not to hear them or not. Courts of Appeals typically have to take all appeals from trial courts. So, in other words, if a Supreme Court has said something, it's a Court of Appeals job not to try to overturn it or to change it. It's the Court of Appeals job to follow it. That's kind of the way our judicial system hierarchy works. So when this case goes to the Court of Appeals, a lot of people are thinking it's kind of a no-brainer. You've got this Supreme Court decision from way back when. that says you got to have an offsetting benefit. There's no offsetting benefit in Marin County. What's the issue? Well, a three-judge panel, a unanimous three-judge panel, said the county can reduce benefits for existing employees without an offsetting benefit. Now, getting to that conclusion, the court had to follow a road that I think is a pretty difficult one. And what is that difficult road? It's this 33-year-old Supreme Court decision. And I'm going to read you the one sentence from that 33-year-old opinion that the Court of Appeals has to overcome in order to rule in favor of the cut in benefits. Here's the sentence. With respect to active employees, we have held that any modification of vested pension benefits must be reasonable, must bear a material relation to the theory, why it is the benefits are being reduced, and successful operation of a pension system, and when resulting in a disadvantage to employees, and I'm going to stress this next word a lot, when resulting in a disadvantage to employees, must be accompanied by comparable new advantages. That's the word, must, that the Court of Appeals has to overcome. And what the court ends up saying is, we think the Supreme Court actually meant should or may instead of must. And therefore, Marin County was not required to offset the cut in pension benefits by not including this supplemental pay in the calculations, wasn't required to offset it with some corresponding benefit. So how do we get to the point where, in the Court of Appeals judgment, must means should or may or kind of ought to think about it? Here's what the Court of Appeals said. First of all, the court says, we have a good reason to question whether the Supreme Court actually meant must when it used that word, because there were a number of other decisions that were issued by the Supreme Court about the same time, one within a month of the most important decision, a couple of other decisions where the Supreme Court didn't use the word must. Instead, it used what the Court of Appeals is now describing as a should formulation. Secondly, the Supreme Court has never repeated must. It instead has, when it has decided these cases, employed the word should. And therefore, we think it's unlikely that the Supreme Court's use of must 33 years ago, even though it wasn't overturned, we think the Supreme Court's use of must was not intended to, and here's the Court of Appeals again, herald a fundamental doctrinal shift. Should and not must is what the law should be. And what does should mean? The Court of Appeals says should does not convey imperative obligation, no more compulsion than ought. Should is a recommendation, not a mandate. So what constitutional protections do these active employees who've been making pension contributions on the supplemental pay, what constitutional protections do they have if must means should or ought? And here's what the Court of Appeals said. The court says modifications must of a pension system, i.e. reductions, must be reasonable. And it's for the courts to determine the facts as to what constitutes a permissible change. And what's the operative test going to be? I'll read you the one sentence is that the court is citing as the new test. And see what you think. how much protection that gives to existing employees. To be sustained as reasonable, alterations of employees' pension rights must bear some material relation to the theory of the pension system and its successful operation, and that changes and modifications do not invariably work to the employee's benefit. I'm sorry, I said one sentence. I'm going to read three. Back to the court. Reasonable modifications can encompass reductions in promised benefits. Short of actual abolition, a radical reduction of benefits or fiscally unjustifiable increase in employee contributions, the guiding principle is still that the governing body can make reasonable modifications and changes before the pension becomes payable and employees don't have a right to any fixed or definite benefits, but only to a substantial or reasonable pension. So that's the test. Employers can reduce benefits in a pension system for existing employees so that 24-year, 11-month employees got a month to go to hit 25 years. Their pension can be reduced, even though they've made contributions on their pension plan. Their pension can be reduced so long as it is not, and I'm quoting, a radical reduction in benefits. Oh my, my, is that door open to the reduction of pension benefits for existing employees? So what's going to happen with this case? California actually has a bunch of different courts of appeals that have different geographic responsibility. This is the Court of Appeals in the San Francisco area. One Court of Appeals in California, believe it or not, is not obligated to follow what another Court of Appeals does. So it's hard to tell how much in the way of legs this is going to have at the Court of Appeals level. But most importantly, this is a Court of Appeals telling a Supreme Court, when you said must, you really meant ought. That is almost like throwing down the gauntlet to a Supreme Court, without regard to whether the Supreme Court, buys the theory that must means ought. It's not the job of a Court of Appeals to tell a Supreme Court what it meant. I think there's a reasonable chance, more than a reasonable chance, that the California Supreme Court will hear this case on appeal and will get a brand new decision on this whole issue. Probably going to be a blockbuster decision. So watch out for this one. This is the case name is called the Marin County the Employees Retirement Association. Basically, that's essentially the name of the pension board there. And now I want to do something I don't normally do in these podcasts, and that is tell war stories. I promise it'll be brief, and I promise, I hope, it'll be interesting. But the court's decision here that must means ought or should actually takes me back to a case I once handled. And I'm not going to tell you the state name, because that'll give away who the client was. I'll just tell you, it's a case that involved state troopers in a western state where there was no collective bargaining. And this is a state where the state government is generally thought to be, shall we say, rough and tumble. Well, I got hired by the Troopers Association in the state a number of years ago, got hired to represent them on a day-to-day basis, and they didn't have collective bargaining, so there wasn't, a ton I could be doing other than handling disciplinary appeals and trying to weigh in on a variety of workplace issues, but it wasn't like we were actually bargaining a contract. Well, one of the things I did, coming into a new state, was to read the statutes, and lo and behold, there in the middle of the statutes was what's known as a prevailing wage clause. Prevailing wage clause, in this case, said that state employees had to be compensated at the prevailing wage for similar positions outside of state employment. And it actually didn't read had to be compensated. It actually read must be compensated. at the prevailing wage for non-state employees doing similar work. Well, turned out that the Department of Personnel in this state had done a wage study, bless you, and the wage study showed that troopers were 26.2% behind the wages for law enforcement officers. That's what the state's own study showed. So I suggested to the Troopers Association, they agreed, to file a lawsuit saying we want to enforce the prevailing wage language. And we won in the trial court level. The trial court said, hey, must means must, and we know what the prevailing wage is. It's from the Department of Personnel study. Give them all a raise immediately, a 26.2% raise to all state troopers. And the state appeals and goes up to the state Supreme Court. And I go down, I'm kind of revealing what direction this case is. So I go to the state and argue the case before the Supreme Court. It seems like a very perfunctory oral argument to me. The judges didn't seem to be all that interested in the case. There weren't many questions. It was an odd sort of non-interactive oral argument, the sort that always gets me a little bit worried about what's going on. And then months pass, and months pass, and months pass, and no decision. And I'm thinking this is an easy case, right? Must means must. There's lots of law in this state that must means must. And then I get a call from the president of the Troopers Union, and he said, uh-oh, I just heard a rumor. And the rumor I'm hearing now for some very good sources, and these are sources in the legislature, that there's been a deal cut. And the deal is the Supreme Court, which has wanted a new building for years and years and years, the Supreme Court is going to get a new building authorized by the legislature. They're going to appropriate the funds for a new Supreme Court building. And in exchange, we lose our lawsuit. And I said to him, that's crazy. That doesn't happen. I mean, you know, Supreme Court justices don't make decisions on that basis. And sure enough, a month later, the Supreme Court of the state comes down with a decision that says, must means may, and you lose. And sure enough, within a few months of that, the legislature in the state appropriates money for a new Supreme Court building. I'm proud to say it's a very nice-looking Supreme Court building. Appropriates money for that. Later on, the legislature, about a year later, gets around to raising the wages of troopers by about 25%. So we got our message through, and the troopers got their money. When I'm thinking about this Marin County case, I'm hearkening back to my own case where a court ended up saying must meant something other than may. A case that I now think about in my memory as the only occasion in my career where I may have lost a lawsuit to a building. Who can say that, really? I have time for a few more cases that I want to get to, including a whopper of a promotional rules case. But before I do, I just want to remind you about something. Come to our website, LRIS.com, and check out our new mobile app development platform. I'm a big believer in the notion that every law enforcement, fire protection, corrections, labor organization ought to have a mobile app. And every police department, sheriff's department, correctional facility, or fire department should have a mobile app to be able to communicate with employees, members, and the public at large. We've got a platform that we've been working on, and it's now in use. We've got about 10 organizations that are using it out there that allows you to create a mobile app with no programming knowledge and at a fraction of what it costs a web design company to build one from scratch. Our costs range from $55 to $75 a month, depending upon the payment plan that you choose, And we're currently waiving our normal design fee. Our design fee is $400. We're waiving that because we want a lot more people to be trying this out. And it's not, it's beyond the beta test version, but we do want a lot of people trying it out and giving us feedback. All you have to do is give us your logo and the artwork and photos you want us to include, and we will build the app for free. I don't usually push anything that LRIS does on these podcasts, but, you know, I listen to a whole lot of podcasts. I love podcasts. What a wonderful form. And all of them are supported by advertisements of one thing or another. And, you know, at least if I'm going to do an advertisement, it's going to be for LRIS itself and for something I really believe in, our mobile app. It's not going to be for a mattress or something like that that I hear on some of my favorite podcasts. All right, let's get back to recent developments, and let's talk about this promotional case. A big deal here. It's out of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. North Carolina, as a reminder, a non-union state. There's no labor, public safety labor organizations in North Carolina. The rights that employees have to collectively bargain, or should not to collectively bargain, the rights they have coming out of their job depend on the employer's own rules, and occasionally there's some statutes that that might exist for state employees and other employees. So there's no bargaining implications to any of this stuff. So here's what's going on in this case. It's a promotional case. It involves a fellow named Kevin Tully, who's a police officer, at least starts off as a police officer, for the Wilmington, North Carolina Police Department. Tully gets promoted to the rank of corporal in 2007, and the year after that he gets assigned to the department's violent crime section, where he becomes an all-star. He works on more than 50 homicide cases. He's got 100% clearance rate. I know, clearance rates, I understand. But he's got 100% clearance rate. He's named Wilmington Police Officer of the Year, and in 2014, he's actually given the Public Safety Officer Medal of Valor, which is one of the highest, maybe even the highest award given to law enforcement officers in the country. So Tully is definitely an all-star. In 2011, he decides he wants to get a promotion to the rank of sergeant. And so he follows the policies and procedures that are in place within the department. No civil service system here, by the way, just policies set up by the department. They've got a multi-phase promotional process. You start with a written exam, and then you move on to different other phases, and eventually successful candidates who complete all of the specified phases are put on an eligibility list. And the police chief then looks at the files of everybody on the eligibility list, looks at the good, bad, and ugly in their personnel files, and then he selects people for promotion from the list. The chief, it's not rank-ordered promotion at all. It's kind of the promotional system, bluntly, you'd expect to see in a non-union state. Finally, the chief's selections have to be approved by the city manager. So that's what they've got. Tully sits for the written exam for a sergeant's position, and it gets notified that he failed it. When he finds that out, he gets pretty surprised, and he is entitled to a copy of the correct answers for the written exam, and he notices that a number of the correct answers were actually wrong. By correct answers, I mean the ones that the test treated as correct, were wrong and were based on outdated law, particularly with respect to search and seizure. I told you Tully was an all-star here. This is a guy who's reading the law and deciding that the entire promotional examination is in part based on incorrect and outdated statements of the law. Tully files an internal grievance under the city system challenging the promotional examination and the process. City manager, who gets to decide the grievances, simply says promotional examinations aren't grievable, and Tully doesn't give up. He appeals into the court system. And this is what goes to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, And in what I was kind of a surprise to me, the court rules in Tully's favor. Sort of. I mean, it keeps the case alive. It doesn't say Tully wins, but it sends the case back down to the trial court for more information. What's the legal theory here? The court says we have a provision in our state constitution, and this exists, by the way, in many state constitutions, that we refer to as our Equal Protection Clause. And under our jurisprudence, arbitrary and capricious acts by government violate the Equal Protection Clause. What the court ends up saying is that the purpose of this Equal Protection Clause is to protect people against intentional and arbitrary discrimination. Whether that discrimination comes about, that treatment, arbitrary and intentional treatment, comes about by the express terms of a statute or by improper execution of a statute by the government. As the court puts it, and this is a quote, an agency of the government must scrupulously observe rules, regulations, or procedures which it has established. When it fails to do so, its action cannot stand, and courts will strike it down. And the court says, now let's look at Tully. It is wrong. It is arbitrary for a governmental entity to promulgate promotional procedures and then fail to follow them. And that means it is wrong if the city of Wilmington, in fact, based its promotional examination on incorrect assumptions of the law. It is wrong and it is arbitrary for the city to have done so. Now, the court says, look, we're being careful. This is a case that was dismissed without any trial down below. We're not saying Tully wins. What we are saying is Tully has sufficiently alleged claims of arbitrary and capricious action by the city in its failure to follow its own procedures. That means there's issue of fact to be resolved. Go ye forth back down to the trial court level where you can engage in discovery and you can go through the summary judgment process and, if need be, a trial. Interesting case, right? There's some sort of constitutional right that an employee has to compel a governmental body to follow its own promotional procedures. Now, there are a few other cases from other jurisdictions that do say that, but there's not an awful lot of them. And for this to come down out of one of the most conservative courts in the country, the North Carolina Court of Appeals, is a bit of a surprise. So a case I'm certainly going to continue the saga of Kevin Tully to the extent it produces more reported opinions. All right, I've got time for one more case here. I knew I shouldn't have talked about losing a case to a building, but I couldn't resist, and I'm running out of time. But I do want to talk about an ADA case, Americans with Disabilities Act case, because it's not a new principle, but it's an important principle to kind of keep in the back of our heads when we think about an employer's obligation to reasonably accommodate somebody's disability and what happens when that reasonable accommodation obligation runs up against a seniority clause in a collective bargaining agreement where the accommodation might be to give the employee an assignment that with their seniority they would not otherwise be entitled to under a collective bargaining agreement. This is a case comes out of Illinois. And it's one of these names I'm no doubt going to pronounce wrong, so I apologize to Jessie Korinich. I will call her Korinich. Korinich is hired by the Illinois State Police in 2001. The State Police, it was aware of the fact that Korinich had type 1 diabetes at the time she was hired, And her diabetes appeared to be well controlled. She'd been treated by an endocrinologist who used a program aimed at maintaining her blood sugar levels and reducing the risk of diabetic complications. However, in a very short period of time after the state police hired Korinich, she experienced two hypoglycemic episodes in which her blood sugar got so low that she lost consciousness. One of them occurred while she was on patrol, and it ended up with her driving erratically for several miles. She ran a red light, drove over the dotted center line, collided with several other vehicles at a high rate of speed. Firefighters had to cut the roof off a car to extricate her, and she basically had no memory of that particular episode. When this happens, the state patrol, or state police, puts her on restricted duty status and decides to evaluate whether or not she can continue to be a state trooper. She goes through all sorts of medical examinations, and eventually state police decides she can't perform the essential functions of the job. And they begin the reasonable accommodation process, what the ADA refers to as an interactive process. They meet with Korinich. They talk over what job she can do with her diabetes, where she could apply for reassignment. All of the jobs are civilian jobs and non-sworn jobs. One even involved a salary considerably higher than she was receiving in her state trooper position. And instead, Korinich said, no, what I want, how you can reasonably accommodate me, is I want a day shift, because the night shift causes my blood sugar levels to become unstable, and that leads to complication for diabetes. By the way, that's not something she and her doctor are actually making up. That is a complication that some people with diabetes do, in fact, have. The state police says, no, we're not going to put you in a patrol position, and make your mind up. Do you want one of these non-sworn jobs? Eventually, Korinich says, no, I don't. The state police treats that as a resignation, and Korinich sues and says that what the state police ended up doing was a violation of the ADA. And that ends up going to a federal court. And federal court rejects the lawsuit. What the federal court says is really two things that I think are most important. The first is that one of the essential functions of the job of a state trooper is being available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for emergency call-ups in case of might be an arrest or a civil disturbance or some sort of natural disaster or whatever it might be. Korinich can't do that. By her own doctor's position, she can't be working at night. Therefore, she cannot perform the essential functions of the job of a state trooper. And the second thing the court says is in the context of addressing Korinich's day shift argument. The court says, look, the employer here has an obligation to comply with the seniority system that's in place in a collective bargaining agreement and apparently even predated the collective bargaining structure. And under Supreme Court law, if an accommodation violates a bona fide seniority clause or practice, the accommodation is by definition not reasonable. If the obligation to accommodate an employee, this is not just an ADA issue, this also occurs with religious discrimination cases and the obligation to accommodate religious beliefs. There's lots of people who don't want to work on their Sabbaths. If an accommodation would cause the employer to violate a seniority clause wins, unless the seniority clause was adopted as a subterfuge for discrimination. And of course, it's been many, many, many years since anybody has found that a seniority clause has been adopted as a subterfuge for discrimination. So, again, not terribly new law. There is this Supreme Court case that's been around for some time. It's called Barnett, I think it is, that holds the same thing. But this is a good reminder of that fact. Well, that's it for our September first Thursday. As we head into fall, I wish you all the best of luck in day-to-day activities. Look forward to seeing you, as always, at an LRIS seminar. The next big one that we've got coming up is in November. It's in Las Vegas, and we're going to be holding a seminar on critical incidents, and not just critical incidents, but also the relationship between an employer's disciplinary investigation system and critical incidents. We're going to have, a very exciting program there with lots of people from different disciplines, district attorneys, criminal defense lawyers, human factors psychologists, and the like. Hope to see you at that seminar. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.